We're back again. Joining us this week, and now entering the once again the ultra elite tier of 2-time Chapo guests is Libby Watson. Libby, what's up?
Hi, thank you for having me back. Do I get a set of steak knives or anything yet?
No steak knives yet. Only Derek Davison has gotten steak knives so far, but you will have a jersey that's raised to the rafters of the Park Slope mansion.
Fantastic.
But yeah, we're back again. It's the new year, and everything is just leading up to the inauguration, which I do want to talk about. But I think the theme to open this year and this incredibly slow and shitty news week is, Matt, something you said, where now we're really in the calm before the shitstorm or shitquake, or choose your natural disaster and add shit to it because it's coming.
Yeah. It's like everyone is sort of in an intermediate stage of Kubler-Ross cycle, depending on the individual, but no one is anywhere near acceptance yet. So everybody's just kind of freaking out and I think mostly in denial still.
I mean, I feel like I'm in denial too.
Yeah.
You know, like, because it really hasn't sunk in yet, and it's not going to probably until halfway through this year. But you know,
I think that first Trump State of the Union, that's going to be something, man. That's going to be so a good. Real he's bracing
gonna,
shot, I think.
He's going to do crowd work.
I don't know if we talked about it on the show, but Matt, you had another chilling thought about, like, if he has to address the nation after some kind of tragedy mass shooting.
It's like
that's going to be like
it's bad. The guns. It's too bad. People get to die, but the guns. We love them. We love the guns, folks.
His address after a terrorist attack would be unimaginably bad. It would be so depressing.
Oh yeah, he'll basically get gangs of people on street corners throughout America with pitchforks and shit going after Muslims. I mean, it would definitely happen. He'd be like, folks, your neighbors, you can't trust them. You don't know what these people are from,
folks. They have sushi at 7-Eleven now.
I'm just waiting for maybe some ISIS attack in Vegas at like the Bellagio or something. And he's like, folks, this would not have happened at a Trump casino. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Look, we have the tightest security and the loosest slots. Well, I mean, this is all, you know, counterfactual speculation about the future. But there are things happening in the present. And there's a few, I think, a few news items and articles of note worth discussing this week. The first of which is this whole thing that went down with like attempts to basically gut the House Ethics Committee that was proposed at the beginning of the week, and I think since scuttled by the Republicans. But Libby, I wanted to ask you about this because you've done a lot of work in the sort of field of government transparency and accountability, and I was wondering if you could sort of explain to us what went down with this ethics committee snafu.
And really explain it in layman's terms.
Sure, yeah. So last night, I think, the House, or was it the night before? I think it was the second. Republicans voted to, like, not remove the independent ethics, the Office of Congressional Ethics, but just to make it completely toothless. I mean, you know, provisions in there included that they weren't allowed to hire a communications person. You know, they wouldn't be allowed to have a spokesperson or a press secretary, which just seems really dickish. You know, I don't really know how that helps them. It just seems like a real
dick
move.
Can they have a Twitter account?
Right, yeah, I mean,
only Elo.
So, yeah, I mean, things like that just made it, you know, completely toothless. Obviously, everyone got very mad about that. And they have since reversed this policy after, but not necessarily because, Donald Trump also tweeted that this was a bad idea. It's very frustrating to see people kind of giving Trump credit for this. Even Peter Dow, I think, was saying that we should give him credit for when he's right.
Resistance.
Hashtag resistance.
Exactly. Buy the t-shirt. You know, his tweet said something like, here it is, with all that Congress has to work on, do they really have to make the weakening of the independent ethics watchdog as unfair as it is their number one act and priority? So he's like, he's saying, yeah, it is shit. Ethics is shit, but, you know, they should work on other things. Like, it's
once
not,
again, he shows
it's not a good statement
to be a complete moron, as we know, because it has to be the first thing they do, because it's what they do at the beginning of the Congress to set the rules for the session. They can't do it
right
after.
It's like, they weren't even in session
they
yet.
Have
like,
to do
they
it
couldn't.
First so like even when he makes like this standing that's supposed to show his, it's like from a perspective of just blinkered idiocy. Like, that's the best hope, is that he's so stupid that he just accidentally is correct.
I just, I mean, like, getting off on, like, the Peter Dowd tangent, but he is indicative of a certain type of mindset that is, like, obsessed with this idea that, like, Donald Trump is, you know, a foreign agent of influence, is a dictator, but yet he should get brownie points when he does, like, you know, tweets in favor of the ethics committee or, like, does one thing correctly, that he's like, look, I'm big enough to admit when the other side is like, no, fuck the other side, dude. Like, what are you holding out for? Like, who's going to give you points for showing how magnanimous you are?
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, like, I think
Aaron Sorkin, he's taking
notes. No, there are plenty of, like, moderates and liberals. You know, it's basically, you know, a breed of Ron Fournierism. You know, it's like, if the idea is right, then we have to give credit to the person saying it, even if that person is Donald fucking Trump.
But Fournier,
you know, like,
to defend Ron, even Ron was like, no, Donald Trump didn't save the ethics committee. But Peter Dow, who's, like, paid to be a partisan, as opposed to Ron, who's paid to be nonpartisan, like, Ron should be the leader of the resistance, not Peter.
For sure.
And, of course, the real sad thing is that this independent, quote-unquote, ethics committee sucked anyway. Like, it was bad to begin with.
I'm sure it was mostly toothless, but, like, Libby, I wanted to ask you, like what does this augur in terms of, like, if this is the first thing on the House Republicans' agenda, right, is to just clear this out of the way? I mean, like, they're probably still stung from, like, the Jack Abramoff thing, right? Like, they just want to go back to that, but without even that minor hurdle to clear, right?
Right. Well, this office was actually set up after the Jack Abramoff scandal. Like, it was set up in response to that. So, you know, it's like, it was clearly, you know, necessary, but, you know, not exactly great at what it did. Like, it often would just fail to rule on issues. Like, it would open an investigation and just never close it, so that they would never have to either, you know, clear lawmakers or actually sanction them. I think the New York Times said that in 21 out of 68 cases, they just haven't made a ruling. So that's, like, a significant amount, you know, almost a third of the cases, they just wouldn't make a ruling, which isn't great. But clearly, you know, if the Republicans were going after it, they were going after it for a reason. And, you know, that's to just, you know, gut any kind of oversight. And, you know, they have brought down sanctions in the past. But I mean, to that point, you know, I wonder if they, you know, just feel like the Trump way of doing things is just to do shit and get away with it by pretending it's fine, by just saying that it's fine and, you know, ignoring it when people criticize you. And I guess they found that didn't work in this case, which I guess is slightly encouraging. It's hard to feel encouraged by literally anything right now because, you know, everything is shit. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, people, you know, reporters are saying that members are saying that what swayed them was the number of calls they got to their offices. So that does show that, you know, maybe this kind of direct action will be something that we can turn to in the next 4 years, you know, which is, you know, I think kind of basically our only hope.
Libby, hell, I ain't afraid to use the word. I'm talking about ethics. Ethics. Have John Polito call your local congressman and constituent pressure. Moving on from that, the other item that I definitely wanted to ask you about this week was, this is in the Washington Post. It's the Democratic Party builds a war room to battle Donald Trump. Okay, I'm just going to read from this article. It was in the Washington Post this week. It says, the Democratic National Committee is building a war room to battle President-elect Donald Trump, pressure the new Republican administration on a variety of policy matters, and train a spotlight on Russia's alleged cyber attacks to influence the 2016 election.
Great. Hell yeah. They're going to take that. They're going to take back the courts, legislature, because everyone cares about the Russia issue. That's why Hillary won in the first place.
Well, here's the punchline. It says the DNC's new communications and research operations, to be staffed by former aides to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaigns, will be one of the several efforts from across the Democratic firmament to take on Trump, including the office of Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer, the Center for American Progress, and American Bridge. So, like, their new plan to wage a war against Trump is to create an organization staffed exclusively by people who just lost to Trump.
It's kind of, do you guys remember the movie Casino Royale?
Yes.
Remember when James Bond lost all that money gambling? And he was like, Vespa, I need another $10 million. And she goes, James, no, because women don't ever want men to have fun. And anyway, he has to get it from the CIA. But he's like, by losing to Le Chiffre, I know how to beat him. And that's some, you know, failure success shit. So Peter Dow and Robbie Mook are James Bond. Hillary is Vesper Lynd because she's holding the purse strings with $30 billion in dark money. And this is them going back to the table to gamble against Trump, who is Le Chiffre.
Well, yeah, Trump showed his tell by winning the presidential election. They're like,
wow, this is, Trump has a very complex game. When you let him campaign in Wisconsin, he wins that state. Wow, I've learned a lot competing against this
intriguing
guy.
But let me, I just want to run through it says there's other people here. The DNC has hired John Neffinger, a longtime operative who runs the Franklin Forum, to serve as interim communications director and oversee the national party's operation. He will be joined by two Clinton veterans who spent the campaign focused on Trump, researching his background, monitoring his statements, and trying to drive negative media coverage of his candidacy. Libby, what do you make of this? And this, like, the idea, like, what are they? They're going to still find embarrassing audio and video clips of Donald Trump that are out there?
Yeah, right. I have a lot of thoughts about this as a survivor of the Brock world. I worked at Media Matters for a year, and I'm really sorry for that. And the three people that are outlined in this Washington Post piece, John Neffinger from the Franklin Forum, which is I'm not really sure what they do. I think they like train progressives who are going on TV to say progressive things. And, you know, they do like media training and give them talking points and stuff. And then the other two are Zach Petkanis, who I overlap with a little bit at Media Matters. He was there for a few months as a communications guy. And Adrian Watson, who was at Correct the Record. And now we all know Correct the Record from this last cycle as the organization that said it was going to spend $1 million on doing good posts about how Hillary is nice in order to win the election. I don't know whether they ever really did, because like it's really hard to track that stuff. I found a few Twitter accounts that were definitely run by them, and they were literally just bots. They would find like, you know, accounts like, you know, Deplorable Steve or like Trump Kike, you know, 1488, and reply to them saying, "Love wins," and that was the $1 million expenditure there. So Adrienne Watson, she was their comms director, and now she has a job as the DNC's press secretary. Zach Petkanis, his other roles other than Media Matters were the Hillary campaign and Wendy Davis, the Wendy Davis campaign. Which was,
oh my god, she killed it.
Yeah, she's current governor of Texas.
And then John Neffinger, I know nothing of the Franklin Forum, but I did used to see him around the office, and he always used to walk around with an iPad tucked into the back of his jeans.
Alpha.
In my head, he was always iPad jeans. But
did
I think
he have
it
giant pockets, or did he just stuff it into his waistband?
Tucked
into the waistband.
Yeah. He's like Raylan Givens.
It was just hanging out the waistband of his jeans.
He's like Raylan Givens, and he pulls it out. He can draw and cite a source quicker than anybody.
Yeah, he's like a cowboy with the iPad. He just whips it out. No, like, so basically this means that the DNC has appointed someone to be the comms director who has an iPad for an ass, which I think is a great...
Hell yeah.
Great.
Look.
But, I mean, look, you want to have an organization staffed by professional Democrats. They're going to be losers. I mean, that's all they've got. They've got a collection of massive fucking losers. All the winners, the guys who won for Obama, went off to, like, you know, work with Uber or
work for David Cameron.
Yeah. Like doing startups for billions of dollars about monetizing, you know, human emotions. I mean, that's they're all stacking, you know, stacking the money. All that's left in the sad pool of DC are these congenital fucking losers.
Right. I mean, there are like the odd bright spots. I mean, like, obviously there's, as we all remember, Zach from the DNC,
man,
who stole our hearts.
Chapo fan.
Yeah, he is. He is a listener,
proud listener of the show.
Yeah, he's extremely cool. And, they could have gone in a more Zach from the DNC direction. They could have at least, you know, listened. But instead, they've picked people from, you know, pretty much exclusively from the worst operations to support Hillary. You know, Correct the Record, just a resounding failure. you know, Media Matters, whatever the fuck the Franklin Forum is. Like, no one has
even heard of it. It's actually a web forum. It's a web forum where you where you post and you can earn Hillary points for all the posts.
It's the Franklin
Forum.
Yeah.
It's called the Franklin Forum because everybody is exhibiting tertiary syphilis.
The only avatar you can use is the turtle from the children's cartoon Franklin. No, look, I mean, these people have tried and true methods, and the Democrats are going to win the midterms because they made Peter Dow post in all caps about Russia, and they found a tape of Trump saying, "little homie gay ass." Like, it's going to work.
Well, this is the most offensive thing for me, because, like, Brock said, you know, during the campaign, like, you know, we've got more footage on Trump than anyone, and we're gonna be mining this stuff, and that didn't fucking work. And then after the election, he said, you know, we're gonna have more people devoted to looking into Trump than anyone else. And I'm like, you just fucking did that, and it didn't work. It clearly showed that you can look into him all you want, and, you know, you can find a video of him saying, you know, literally, "I sexually assault women." It doesn't fucking matter.
Libby, do you remember when, like, before the pussy grabber tape, David Brock posted, like, "We will give you $5 million if you give us a tape of Trump."
Oh yeah,
right.
It was like, wait, what happened to looking for?
Wait. But, like, this was late in the election, after he had already claimed that, like, he has all of the goods on Trump,
and he's already taken
money from everyone to do precisely this. And then, like, with 3 weeks left in the election, he's like, "By the way, if you have any really good dirt on Trump, I'll pay you $5 million."
What a fucking incompetent cokehead moron! Oh my god, never put a cokehead in charge of your operation, because he's going to go out in the media like David Brock and be like, "I have every tape of Trump saying everything ever," and then just, like, play solitaire in his office and sweat for 6 months, and then he's gonna be like, oh shit, the polls are tightening.
But I mean, don't they know by now that nobody gives a shit?
Like, no one cares. Like,
even if they found them, it wouldn't matter. Nobody cares. Like, at a very basic level, that kind of public square that's supposed to reprove people for violating norms of decency doesn't exist.
Right.
And they seem to be totally unable to process that reality.
Right. Trump already has very low favorability ratings. Like, I don't know how much lower they think they're going to be able to push it in a way that will actually, you know, clearly people voted for him despite thinking he's a dick, you know, despite knowing he's a dick. Like, that just did that to a, you know, significant number of people. That didn't matter. I also just want to point out that $5 million that Brock offered for that tape, he didn't offer it to people. He said he would give it to veterans. He said, "I'll give the veterans $5 million, but only if you can get me a tape of, you know, Trump being a Nazi."
He's
or whatever.
He's so good. He's so good. Amazing. "If you give me a tape of Trump kissing his daughter, I will raise money for bullying and the knockout gets knockout game relief." Like, what a fucking huckster. He is the greatest. I mean,
you know who else like to do that, though? You know who else like to make fake bets and fake claims that he would give millions of dollars to veterans if
Hulk
tapes
Hogan,
things came out? A little guy named Donald motherfucking Trump. Remember during said, "If President, give me a birth certificate, I'll give $1 million to veterans." They're the same fucking assholes.
Do you remember?
This is the thing. He's just a slimier, less successful Trump. He's just a shittier version of Trump.
It was like late in the campaign, but, like, someone just dug up, like, the old media hits on Trump, and one of them included a story about how he showed up at like an AIDS charity gala ball and, like, got on stage despite not having been invited or given money, and just got photographed giving the thumbs up, and he was like, "I support this. I'm Trump, everybody," and then left. So yeah, that's brilliant. I'm glad we got some top minds. But, like, isn't this just another spectacular example of failing upwards if you fail in a big enough way for the right people?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just failing people, though. It's a failing strategy. Like, I've heard a lot of fucking bellyaching from Clinton people after the election. That's like, the media was totally aligned against us, and it's like, no, they weren't. It's just that the media is shitty and that, like, 90% of Americans hate it and don't care about it.
Yeah, nobody cares, like, about the fucking thing.
If the media had any effect to
decide it for them, but nobody fucking pays attention. Nobody cares anymore. It's just
everyone hates the media.
They're, like, siloed interests and their siloed media that they consume, mostly Facebook memes, and that everything else they just fucking ignore. And that's everyone. There's just, it doesn't exist. Like, this public square is, it's overgrown. Right. It's filled with weeds and dogs are shitting in it and fucking at random. There's nothing. There's nobody there anymore. Get right. over it.
This is what worries me most about like the next 4 years going forward is that, you know, it's the same with the ethics committee stuff. Like, in general, Democrats just don't recognize that Republicans are playing an entirely different game, completely happy to lie, and they don't care if they're fucking hypocrites.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Mitch McConnell today said that the American people will not tolerate Democrats blocking a SCOTUS nomination.
Hilarious.
Which they've been doing for a fucking
hilarious.
Year. Which is like, right, and it's like, you know, liberals, Democrats, you know, Vox.com fucking lanyard dick iPad asses think that if you, like, if you just point that out, if you say, ah, oh, good sir, but actually, you know, you've been doing this for a year, then that's the fucking debate won, and therefore that means they win. But no, you know, it doesn't matter if you win the debate anymore.
Yeah, I mean, like, the good thing about that is that, guess what, Mitch McConnell, bitch? Nobody cared when you were blocking Obama's nominee. That means nobody's going to give a shit when they block Trump's nominee either.
Yes, absolutely.
So fucking dead.
I mean, if they actually do it.
Nobody cares. No, but the rules are it's gone, like, baby. Just do what you fucking – just do whatever you can get away with,
but
regardless
of what's nobody really thinks that the Democrats are going to go to the mattresses and do whatever it takes to torpedo any of Trump's nominations, albeit – but, like, maybe they can keep John Bolton out of the State Department. I fucking
because
hope
of Rand.
So.
Because of Rand.
But – like, it's all this complaining about, like mostly from people in the media complaining about how bad the media is just seems like the teacher tattling to themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And Libby, yeah. I'm glad you brought up this idea about, like, hypocrisy and, the bad strategy and just the idea that, like, liberals and Democrats just, like, cannot – they don't understand that they're playing a completely different game than what the right is and are, as such, completely unprepared for what's about to happen to them. I want to just talk briefly about this Michael Tomasky article that came out this week in the Daily Beast. The title of the article is New Year's Resolution for the Left: Make Sure Multiculturalism Includes White People. Now, this is just basically an essay-long elaboration on Randy G. Dubb's tweet that says that the Democrats are going to look hard in the mirror and say to themselves, we got to get more racist. But most of the article isn't worth talking about, but I just want to highlight two places here. In one paragraph, he says, after talking about all the good things that Hillary Clinton was for, and it's the saddest irony of the election that middle and working class people just didn't realize all of the good stuff that she was going to do for them. He says, liberalism needs people who can talk about them the right talk to them in the right way and in the right places. It also needs desperately to spread facts and smother anti-facts. The triumph of anti-facts, a presidential candidate who lied as naturally as he drew breath, the rise of fake news, the plain refusal of 30 or 40% of the population to believe true things, is a major crisis for democracy. Two things I'll say about this. Nobody on the right thinks this way. And in this paragraph that's two sentences long, the second sentence directly refutes the first. So he's talking about how we have to spread facts and smother anti-facts, and then says that 30 to 40% of America plainly refuses to believe at things that are true. So, like, how do you square that? Like, where does that leave right. you if you're going to double down on facts now or going to war right. against anti-facts, which is such a fucking hilarious turn of phrase, anti-facts. It speaks directly to this mindset that I think is so risible.
Right. I mean, he was clearly very proud of himself when he came up with anti-facts. It reminds me of the kind of thing that I would have done, like trying to finish an essay at 4 a.m. at uni, being like, oh, yeah, fuck, that sounds great. Yeah, anti-facts, brilliant. Yeah, I can do a paragraph out of that. Like, it doesn't mean it. Also, like, the refusal of 30 or 40% of the population to believe things is not new. Like, 30% of Americans don't think the fucking moon landing happened. Like, this isn't a Trump thing. It's just a people thing.
Well, the thing to remember is that the Democratic Party is not a political party in the traditional sense. They don't have members. They don't have a mass of people who are organized under the umbrella of the Democratic Party. It's like they have voters. They have consumers who choose Democrat when they go to the polls. You know, like they have people who have a brand preference for Democrats, and
right.
what is needed in a dire emergency like what we're having with this Trump administration and these just psychotic monsters in Congress taking over without any real opposition is the only thing that's going to have any effect on that is mobilized citizenry opposing them. And the Democratic Party is just – it's not equipped to do the job of mobilizing them because it's not a political party. It's a collection of corporate, basically, like the people who are at any corporation, you know, the people in marketing, the people at finance, you know, it's just that it's this white collar 1% layer of people in Washington who work at the party, and then there's everyone else, and there's no connective tissue between those two groups of people. So the only thing they have to do is generate this shit that is directed at each other, at other members of their political and media class, because they have absolutely no connections to anybody else who they actually need to get off their fucking asses if they're going to ameliorate the worst of what's coming.
Matt, that perfectly segues into the second thing I wanted to highlight in this Tamansky piece, which is like, okay, the headline is that we have to make sure multiculturalism includes white people. And you sort of think that it's going to be like, oh, is Tamansky going to be like, we need to, you know, is he going to go on the white working class tip, right? And the answer is he 100% does not. He writes off the quote white working class as completely unreachable through politics and uses this recent election
as
positive of it. But what he does say is he says that the Democrats need to be more comfortable with church-going suburban white people. And he says, I know lots of these people. My dear mom was one and virtually all of her friends from church. Loads of old high school classmates.
That's why she kept an unviable fetus in Michael. Keep it in. Keep it in, Brandon. You're keeping it in.
Mother's politics must be lukewarm. But she said most are more middle class than working class.
No, wait a minute. Yeah. You're telling me that a Democratic operative is suggesting that they concentrate on middle income people?
No way.
I don't believe it.
They may not check every single box. They may squirm a little when the trans bathroom issue comes up. They may think political correctness can be kind of ridiculous.
I'm a bathroom warrior with fire in my eyes.
So what I love about this is he's saying that like white working class people of the kinds in, let's say, just to pick three states at random, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, are unreachable through the Democratic Party message or politics. However, suburban church-going white people are – if you are white, live in the suburbs, and attend church regularly – 99% chance you vote Republican down the line and do so with unchangeable.
Also, this was the exact strategy.
Yes,
the last 4 months of the Clinton campaign was to target people in the Philadelphia suburbs, to target people in the Milwaukee suburbs, to search, as they do in Syria, for the mythical moderate, which doesn't exist. And why the fuck does he bring up bathrooms? Bathrooms are what Ted Cruz tried to salvage his campaign on. It didn't even work with Republican primary voters.
Tamansky is one
of the dumbest fucking people in media. If Tamansky remembers 2006, the group of legislatures that were brought in, who I like to call Rahm Emanuel's bastards, the Blue Dogs... The new wave of Ben Nelson.
Heath motherfucking Schumer
hours. How many of them are still in the House and Senate? Like, none of them. None of them. Because you can't... This is politics as defined by who I am not. And who I am not is like, I am only 70% Republican. And you can't keep somebody in office. Like... People will just take the real thing if you offer them that. You can activate working class votes, not just the white working class votes, if you provide them maybe a once in a generation charismatic politician in Obama. Or absent that, because every other Democrat is a fucking loser who puts iPads in his jeans, an actual program of politics, a simply stated program that speaks their material interests as opposed to... let's get someone in there who's nice to John McCain.
But they can't. They can't do that. And it's not because they don't want to. It's not because they're squeamish. It's because the Democratic Party is a capitalist party.
Yes.
It's because the Democratic Party answers to capitalist interests and promotes – I mean, that's what they're doing. They cannot – if they did that, they wouldn't be the Democratic Party anymore. Like, it's that simple. Like, they cannot do what needs to be done because we don't have a working-class party in the United States. We have a capitalist party that pretends sometimes to be a working-class party. That's it. And that's what this election has done more than anything, is to strip any pretense away from that brutal reality.
Hey, Matt, I have a question. We've talked about this before, that certainly, though, there was a time in which the Democratic Party, while it was never a true workers' party, was actually looking out in a
It made an alliance with labor, right, because labor, right, was powerful, because labor had a lot of members that it could mobilize, and it had a lot of money that they could spend. Right. That doesn't exist anymore. Through the connivance of the Democrats, that's the thing. Like, with Carter in the 70s, they openly colluded to basically destroy American unionism. And then that left them in the absolutely predictable position of not having not only a mass electoral base, but not having a funding source. And that's when the DLC and Clinton showed up and said, hey, why don't we go to Wall Street and get those guys money? And then that's where we've
been ever
since.
Valley.
So that, but that was, and that happened to every, the Labour Party in Britain, that started off as a real workers' party, socialist party in France. I mean, that neoliberal turd happened everywhere. But it was even easier here because in the United States, Democratic Party was always this sort of shell and was always this sort of fake working class party that was just in an alliance almost of convenience with Labour for a time.
I keep thinking about I think it was Conor Kilpatrick, when he was on the show after the election, was saying that, you know, when it comes to black voters, it's like, you know, they don't have a choice because they can either vote for
Democrats
or they can not vote. That's it, yeah. You know, they can either vote for Democrats or they can not vote because, you know, the Republican Party is racist. And it's like, you know, it gets to that point with, you know, with the working class too. Like, where there isn't a party for them. Like, there just isn't anyone who represents their needs at all. And while the Democrats are the closest thing they have, you're right. It's not anything close. They don't care about their interests at all. They don't care about them at all. They just care about fucking Katy Perry and, you know, Yas Queenery and stuff that works on a national.
Yeah, even because they've totally abandoned having any kind of economic agenda. So it's all cultural. Yeah. And like, that does offer something to minority working class people. Like, it genuinely is a difference. It's not just a distinction between Republicans and Democrats. Having somebody like Obama be president, having a party that is vocally inclusive in their rhetoric, that is different than having Republicans in office. And that does provide them something. But like, yeah, I mean, basically what these guys, these Democratic people who are written off the white working class are basically mad at them for not allowing that to be enough. And it's like, I'm sorry, you know, people, not everyone is going to be woke enough to take that kind of cultural signaling as enough of a reason to go vote for somebody.
Right. That's the thing, is you're never going to turn people out that way. Most people don't give a shit. You know, quite correctly, most people recognize that it's not worth their time to find out about a lot of this stuff. It's not worth their time to, you know, do the research on this stuff.
I think it goes back to this idea that, like, if they're counting on, if they're saying that, like, it's more likely that suburban church-going white people are going to vote Democrat than working-class white people, then it's just like, I don't know who the fuck are paying the, like,
suburban church-going white people traditionally have been the social basis for fascism. Wherever it is power.
Yeah, they're
so
the Bavarians. The, like, Bavarians supported the Nazi party.
But like, but this goes to this whole idea too, like that, like, you know, the deplorables are like that there are parts of the white working class that, like, you know, sort of educated cosmopolitan white people find embarrassing or backwards or whatever. I guarantee you that their racism is not nearly as entrenched as the middle to upper middle class suburban variety. Like this whole reformocon thing. Like, I find them in a lot of ways worse.
Well, those are the people who literally either them or their parents move them out to a spot in the middle of nowhere specifically so they wouldn't be around any minorities. Like, and then they've grown up for generations in these fucking these suburban castles. These fucking like the way these people talk about America's cities. They genuinely feel this, like, dread and sense of besiegement and this violent need to quarantine themselves from this mass of filth. Like, that's how they think. I mean, I have relatives like that. And, they're not reachable. And they're definitely worse because they don't have material interests that are in any kind of conflict with the Republican agenda.
Right.
Like, Matt, like, to reach those people would involve giving up far, far more than what the Democrats would need to do to peel off just a percentage of the quote-unquote the white working class vote, right?
Right, and more importantly, like, yeah, maybe you only get a few Trump voters to switch, but you also get people who didn't vote to come out. And though that's like David Cabe had an article recently that was really, really instructive, and more people need to read it to think about how he basically said that the political reality that dominates right now is the amount of slack in the electoral politics of America, in that the vast percentage of people who don't fucking vote. Like, that is the determining reality. And that's what allows these relatively small minorities of pissed off suburban white people to determine elections, is because of the vast numbers of people who just don't do it. And they could be reached, but it would not be – the Democratic Party as it currently exists couldn't do it. They can't get them. And so they gave up smartly because they recognize at a certain level that they're not built to do the job.
I think it's just great that, like, it's always like, you know, people like Tomasky can't possibly admit that maybe the Bernie Bros might be right about the kinds of people that need to be reached. So he's just like
well, he's thinking about his mom.
Any other group. Yeah, exactly. You know, we need to reach the white transphobes to win the election. Like, you know, just anything to not admit that maybe the people who are in his Menchies might be right about the people that need to be reached.
No, they will contort themselves to any belief other than coming around to our sweet dear Bernard brother.
Yeah, no, they will happily just be the polite Republican Party. The one without swears and pussy grabbing.
Yes.
And then there's the part like we talked a number of times about how the GOP primary was like when Rodney Dangerfield went to Bushwood Country Club. give him a few years in office and the Democrats will just turn into Judge Smales, and then the Republicans will be Rodney Dangerfield, and then that's it. They would definitely rather do that than become a genuine opposition.
And like the horrifying part is like these are the people that, for better or worse, we have to rely on to stop the worst of what's coming down the pike, which is unimaginable.
Well, that's why it can't be. That's why we can't rely on them. They can't be the ones. Only as an instrument at the end of a process that starts with actual mobilization of citizens. The creation of, like, for one thing, a lot of people are going to be materially really hurt by what Paul Ryan specifically has in mind in terms of removing people's levels of health care and financial support. And that's going to have to be dealt with either basically only by people coming together to provide mutual aid for one another in an atmosphere of mobilization, of people coming out, people realizing that politics isn't just voting, people realizing that they're going to have to work together through a number of different channels horizontally, and then maybe at the end of that process, just like the civil rights movement, at the end of that process, that moves some legislators to do some stuff as a result of the pressure they're getting from outside.
I'm glad you said that, Matt, because like, I've been struggling with a way to say this on the show, and I've certainly been thinking about it over our New Year's break, and I think it bears saying, at least, that is what politics is. What politics isn't includes things like this show and anything that happens online.
Yes, like, absolutely.
This show is entertainment, right? And I'm incredibly heartened by the number of people who have come out to get involved in, for instance, the DSA or really any political issue at a local or national level. Through organization, through protest, or whatever, that is hugely important, and it really humbles me to hear this stuff from fans of the show. But I do feel the need that we need to be clear that this show is not politics. We're not doing politics on this show. We're talking about it. We're having a good time and hopefully entertaining you. But politics is what happens like in the real world and not online.
Absolutely.
So that's a...
I don't understand the difference.
Good,
There is only one for me, and it is online.
That's my disclaimer for this week. But I'm actually really glad with the way the direction this conversation has led us, because it leads perfectly into my reading series for this week, which touches on a lot of the things we've been talking about, specifically reformocons and the polite Republican Party. And the reading series this week comes courtesy. Matt, you're going to like this. This is a guy named Michael R. Strain. Real Strain hours in the fucking house.
Oh my God, he's one of them. He's a muncher. He's one of the master's
real
minions.
Real motherfucking Strain hours. This guy, he cropped up. This is a guy who I've who's nauseated me for a while now, but he pops up occasionally in the Washington Post in their sort of like post everything opinion section, and he had an article at the end of the year called headline of which was "America owes its working class." Yes, but the working class has duties too.
Sounds
the
subhead good. I'm was, very excited.
As a culture, we feel more comfortable discussing what we want than what we owe.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, yes!
Now, keep in mind, this is just like, I'm going to give you the brief taste of the kind of guy you're dealing with here. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, which, if that's not a real working job, I don't know what is.
Do you think it's easy? Do you think it's easy to spend 8 hours a week writing papers about how we should means test libraries? It's fucking not, dude. It's work.
I'm just going to read briefly from this one as the preamble to the real treat, which is the article that perfectly, you know, will be the mirror of this. So this is America's working class has duties too. He says, I'm reading now. He says, "It seems to me that the sense of duty has eroded, along with the cultural norms that support it. Again, this observation applies generally across our society, but taking the specific case of the working class, its implications are important. Significantly strengthening the cultural norms that if you can find work, you should be working, even if the only job you can find pays a mere 65% of what you made in your last job. If you can work, you should be working, even if you have to move a few states away for a good job."
Oh my
ding,
God.
Ding, 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 Yeah, that's the air horn we set off when a decent, polite, reform conservative simply suggests that you move a couple states to work on an oil derrick in North Dakota.
Despite
the fact that you're like, you know, your last job was
when you got your degree in economics from the Kevin Williams dungeon.
He says, "You should be providing for your kids, and you have an obligation to contribute and to add your skills and talent and effort to the fabric of your community, the one you just moved to a week ago."
Yeah. Shut the fuck up with that fabric of community shit. If your fucking entire political, if your entire economic message to the struggling working class is become a friendless, familyless, social monad bouncing from job opportunity right. to job opportunity, you can't fucking talk about social fabric. You've shredded the social fabric. You wiped your fucking ass with the social fabric.
Get on a boxcar, go to California.
Yeah. This is why these guys like Kasich so much. They're like, oh, what's the problem? He just hopped the train and went to where there was work or a high bottle deposit.
You sleep under a bridge.
I hear they're giving money to put dynamite down a mine.
Oh, I got to get my old lady out of Hawk.
So he keeps going, "A strong recovery of these basic cultural norms." And he keeps going on about cultural norms and strengthening norms. Buddy, the only cultural norm we should be strengthening right now is Norm MacDonald, okay? Sorry. So he goes on, "How? It used to be the case that an able-bodied man who wasn't working would feel much more social stigma than he does today. And stigma can push men on the margin into jobs. Can also push them into crime and drug addiction
fentanyl
as well."
Addiction. Yeah.
He says, "Once employed, it is much easier for those men to meet their obligations and fulfill their duties, to be good fathers to their children, to be good members of their communities, to put down the video game and not use drugs." I mean, again, this anti-gaming message.
Yo,
me.
All right, dude. I'm calling the Grey Wolves, the actual Grey Wolves that Erdogan brought to the Brookings Institute to go to the AIE, because this is hate speech. This is motherfucking hate speech.
So he says, put down the, like, I like the idea that, like, if you're working a job that pays you like a fraction of what your old one did, and that you've had to move your family to work longer hours for less. That helps you be a better father to your children.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, when you you're on like 14 prescriptions because of your back pain that you are unable to afford treatment for and have to ignore because you have to go to work all the time, and then you come home and you see the kids for an hour in a that's great. That, you see the kids like for an hour. Norman Rockwell shit right there.
You see the kids for your wife and kids for like an hour, but like you're so tired and disgusted that like all you can do is take out your anger on them for existing.
Well, yeah, I mean, children do not respect fathers who don't work. Like they can tell how hard they're working, and they will obey them if they know that they're putting the requisite amount of hours, or if they're making, you know, like a good salary at the AIE, for instance.
Yeah, see the way
I know when their dad is a loser. Kids value
the smartest
value
way to
connect
with your kid and maintain authority over them is just stay home and get really fucking good at Halo and then crush them at it. Because they will respect that.
Well, I'm having the idea now that like one of these AEI dickwads could have just be like, look, even if you can't get a job, lie to your family, still leave the house every day with your briefcase, but just go to the park or mall for 8 to 9 hours a day. Come home, just shave, put on a tie, and leave the house so that your neighbors and family think you still have a job. Okay, that's called respect.
That's also the plot of the classic French film Time Out, which is based on a true story, by the way. But at the end of the real story, the guy went home and killed his family and burned his house down.
Matt, that is not how you create a virtuous cycle.
No, it's
a cycle
not.
Of virtue is created by just maintaining that fraud until you find a real job. So yeah, he closes this out by saying, advancing the common good is a duty we all share. We all have obligations to one another and to ourselves. We shouldn't be afraid to say so. In fact, saying so might help us meet those obligations in and of itself.
Yo, that's some secret shit. That's like some success mindset shit, except it's like if you say out loud that you are going to work 60 hours a week by working 2 24-hour days in a row and 1 12-hour day.
These people are the most...
You want fentanyl patches and beat your kids.
Contemptuous pieces of shit on earth. I hate them more than pretty much any other people on earth.
Yeah, no.
There's a central reality about capitalism that it is the ultimate disruptor of tradition and family life. That's been recognized by basically everybody since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. It is a reality that makes me, frankly, respect two different strains of fascist freaks way more than these guys. Like the Douthit communitarian tradcats. They're weirdos. I don't want them to ban Netflix, but I give them respect for them acknowledging that capitalism destroys the things that they cherish and therefore must
be
restrained.
Sacred.
Give them credit for that. Also, I respect the transhumanist, like Nick Land, outright psychopaths who embrace destroying everything that ever existed in human civilization and turning us all into, you know, bio programs, like fucking brains in jars on jetpacks, like buzzing through a completely wasted slag hellscape, shooting each other with lasers. Like people who say, yeah, capitalism's great, it destroys all these stupid bonds of human connection. Human connection's stupid. Give me a robot body and I'll fucking kill everybody. I give both of those, I give way more credit than these line-straddling, deluded shitheads who believe
ethos,
at the same time that they need to allow capitalism to do whatever it needs to do in its absolutely thirstless quench, or it's a quenchless thirst for profit, but also maintain social norms and expectations of civilized society. Those cannot coexist. And that's why right-wingers who realize that and pick one or the other get way more respect from me than these fucking dipshits.
Like I said, this whole thing about the duties of the working class, that was the preamble. And Matt, you said I think you said you couldn't possibly hate this guy even more.
Yeah, I thought so.
Friend... have I got news for you?
Oh,
ooh, boy, it gets worse.
This is the real treat, okay? This is the real reading series, guys. You ready? This is Michael R. Strain. This was from last year in the Washington Post. Headline of this piece is, "Please address me as Mr. I insist." the subhead is how informality hurts us.
Oh, God.
He begins. We were all gathered in the lunchroom of my Catholic grade school. I was in seventh grade, about to receive the sacrament of confirmation. The archbishop wandered in to give us a little pre-mass pep talk. His excellency told us to call him Archbishop Jim. His intention was surely to make us feel more comfortable around him. But I was shocked. He was a direct successor to the apostles. He had the power of transubstantiation in his hands. He could forgive sins in the name of God. At a minimum, he was a lot older than me, and my parents told me to call adults Mr., not Brooke. Archbishop Jim? Nope, I couldn't say it. Again, he was in seventh grade. This is a seventh grader.
What a fucking nerd.
He was born to wear a lanyard.
It gets better. Years later, when I began working at the August American Enterprise Institute, I got to know the August. Years later, when I began working at the August American Enterprise Institute, I got to know the August Charles Murray. So not only is that great writing of just repeating a word again and again, it's also the August Charles Murray. Folks, you may remember Charles Murray from such hits as Black People Be Inferior, Yo. Yeah. And here are some anthropology tips to wooing bar girls in Thailand while you're working for the CIA to destroy their country.
Dude, when Charles Murray bottomed out in Thai 15-year-old girls, he called them ma'am. You know what?
So Michael, he called him Dr. Murray until the third time he told me to call him Charles. So Charles it is, but only by request. Ugh. I was reminded of all this when I read a news account last week of a press conference featuring President Obama and the Chancellor of Germany. My jaw hit the floor when I read the president referring to the Chancellor, Angela Merkel, as Angela. Surely the reporter got it wrong, so I went to the White House transcript and was horrified to see the president referred to the chancellor by her first name nearly two dozen times. He goes on about blah, 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 Angela Merkel, who gives a shit. Our society is suffering from a tyranny of informality. It is rude. It is false intimacy. It is the product of the utopian, egalitarian fiction that society is one big happy village, a friendship circle where we're all holding hands. Station and hierarchy should be leveled because they are so 19th century. In the modern world, we are all
actually
equal.
More like 14th century, like society of order shit.
No, I love that he's like, it's the product of this utopian egalitarian fantasy that we all are equal now, when society is really actually more like the fantasy of the 19th century, or as Matt rightly pointed out, the Middle Ages. So he goes on, he says, he quotes C.S. Lewis, so if you got that in your bingo card for a dickless conservative pundit, you can just sort of X that one out.
Every person I knew in my life who loved C.S. Lewis deserved to be put through a wheat thresher. Every single fucking
100% cosine.
Every single person.
He says it's a lot easier to undergo cancer treatment from Dr. Himes than it is from Ken.
Is it?
My iPad.
I want data on that one. Not to be too Ezra Klein, but I'd like some data on that.
I posted out the screenshot of this guy and his, please address me as Mr., I insist. And Amber had a good nine. Not Chapo Amber, but Philadelphia Amber said that this looks like a missent text to his dom. So he goes on about C.S. Lewis. He goes on and on about Angela Merkel. That really bugged him about Angela Merkel. And I wonder what he felt when George W. Bush like actually goosed her in public.
Yeah, that
was certainly informal.
An unasked for back massage. That seems pretty informal.
It's kind of not surprising that the one leader that he picks is a woman. Like, I think in his first draft, he probably said, you know, she should be called Miss Merkel or Mommy.
If every relationship begins on a first name basis, then I am robbed of the ability to signal to someone that he has become a friend or close colleague by inviting him to address me by my first name. Now, he uses that example, but what he really means is I am robbed of my ability to signal to other people my superiority to them.
100%.
Absolutely. If you want to signal to somebody that they're your friend, you just grab them by the back of the neck and kiss them on the mouth and cup their genitals. That's how you do it. That's how we started the show. We all did it to each other.
He says, if the guy who comes to fix my cable calls me Michael, then what is left for my friends to call me?
A dipshit, asshole, moron, little Lord Fuckpants, lollipop lad.
If my children's friends call me little homie gay ass.
Oh, two little homie gay asses in the episode.
And he says, and isn't it a little easier for the cable guy to give substandard service to Tom than to Mr. Creel? Can we get Brian Quimby on the line? Hold on a second. Can we call Brian Quimby right now and ask him how his customers doing cable installation in rural Ohio referred to him as? It's almost over, but he says, so far, I have suffered in silence, asking to be addressed as Mr. Strain only once years ago during a heated phone conversation with an agent of my health insurance company.
No, sir, we cannot make it bigger. That's not a real surgery. Only in movies.
But yeah, like, so he goes, Chancellor Merkel, certainly not Angela, and perhaps a little more respectful distance through formality for the rest of us, too. After all, it's just good manners. That's the end of the article, but underneath it on the webpage, it says more from Post Everything, and the first link is how I taught my infant son to use an adult toilet.
That's way more useful than this. That's like, a way better article.
But, like, you know, it goes back to, like, the mentality of the Michael Strains of the world, is that, like, in exchange for living this kind of, like, buttoned up, like, utterly dickless fucking lifestyle, what they expect in return is deference from their social inferiors. And that's what they love about, like, you know, like that war room Tom cunt who
I fucking hate
was like
him.
Demanding that people at the supermarket say you're welcome instead of no problem and shit like that. And what I want to say is, like, to give the devil their due for, like, a second, like, look, if you are at, like, a really fancy restaurant or, like, a five-star hotel, then I think it's maybe okay to expect, like, a certain amount of, you know, like, pomp and circumstance because that's what you're paying for. But the way that these people demand the same from, like, just basic, like, customer service employees or people at a supermarket is just fucking sickening.
Put some respect on my name. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they give the game away. They want feudalism. They want a feudal order, but with iPads.
Yeah.
That's sort of why they have this schizophrenic relationship with capitalism, where they want all these social norms to be enforced, even though they endorse a political an economic system that disrupts them. It's because they want the economic dynamism of capitalism that gives them all of the labor saving devices and creature comforts that make their absolutely worthless, lidless, eyelid like fucking, you know, pale, translucent cave fish lives. But they don't want to deal with a society where they don't get just by virtue of their position to be deferred to. Well, and so they just smash them together.
That's why they like Dubai so much. They love Dubai and generally GCC nations because they have every stupid fucking gadget that a moron would want.
it's like a country based on the Sharper Image catalog.
Right, exactly. But you also get to have slaves.
Did you see that idiot that guy that Trump dude who's like where looks like a white Lou Bega, the guy who did like his car.
Grant Kidney.
What is his name? Grant Kidney.
Yeah, Grant Kidney.
Okay, you know,
Grant Kidney?
Yeah, his name is Grant Kidney. Look him up. It's hilarious.
Jesus. No, that's made up.
It's real.
Oh, it's totally real. He did one of those, my favorite genre of video, man sitting in car, like clearly pulled over on the side of the road. You can see traffic whizzing by him. He's just on the shoulder of the road, and he's like, here's why I'm for Israel. Like, it's not because I'm a Republican. And then he goes on to say he's for Israel because it has beaches that are like Miami, coffee shops.
You can't get that in any totalitarian Muslim country.
And it's just like, and he's like, that's civilization. Like, he says that, and like, I love that because like for these people, that is civilization.
Yeah,
Starbucks, baby. But like, I don't know. Something that really stuck with me was when I at a previous job where I was working customer service, just like fielding 300 phone calls a day from like irate people because the piece of shit that they decided to buy on the internet turned out to be a piece of shit. I'll never forget, like, my boss told me, he said, like, consumerism is how we allow people to vent their rage in American society. It's like the acceptable way for people to express how angry they are at their lives and the world that they live in. And I think it's like the, in these transactional relationships, there's like where I'm buying something that's literally just a cheap piece of shit from you, that entitles me to a certain kind of authority or mastery over you. Right. And like that's the deal that we're making with people who are otherwise getting shit on in every other way. Like, this is the whole idea that we've talked on the show before, that like, well, you know, NAFTA is good, but the people's quality of life will be like, the jobs won't matter because their quality of life will be made up for, let's say, in cheap consumer goods and credit. You know, like, that's the deal we're making for with people, rather than any kind of mastery or control over their own lives economically or politically. They can have control over other people's lives, provided that they are slightly lower than
them. Right. I mean, it's very telling that he has this example of, like, the cable guy or whatever, and he's desperate for the cable guy to call him Mr., but there's no mention of whether he'll call the cable guy Mr. You know, like, he's not a person. Like, he's not a person with a first name and a last name. Like, he doesn't have to be addressed in a formal way. He doesn't have to have this like friendship signifier or whatever. Like, that doesn't matter. It's just about him, you know, like being able to exert his authority over this like faceless representation of this company that he's paid money to.
And like the other punchline to Real Strain Hours here is that, of course, he was one of the guys at the beginning of the year, you know, me at the beginning of 2016 versus me at the end. Michael Strain at the beginning of 2016 was writing articles like, Donald Trump is not funny anymore. This is serious. We must stop him. His boorish, you know, like, again, hating Trump for all of the dumbest possible reasons to hate him.
Right.
And then, of course, at the end of the year, he's breaking some kind of record for going from a standing to kneeling position. So, yeah, I think that pretty much sums up everyone who works for the American Enterprise Institute or any of these D.C. think tanks. So that's the reading series for this week. But I, before the show ends, I think we should mention that we're going to be in D.C. very soon for the inauguration.
Yes.
Yay.
Yes, and on January 22nd, I am going to be on the Street Fight Live radio show. I have, where is the venue? Hold on.
Busboys and Poets, I believe.
Busboys and Poets, yes.
Nice.
Yes. Yeah,
we're all going to be hanging out in D.C. For the inauguration. Felix is doing that live show. Chapo as a whole doesn't have a live show set up, but we're definitely going to be hanging out. Like, we're going to pick a bar, probably Comet Ping Pong Pizza.
Yes, definitely.
The secret basement underneath Comet Ping Pong Pizza. We're going to be having a drinks and a meet and greet. So we want to see our fans from the D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region who have thus far been underserved by Chapo live appearances. But like I said, we'll be hanging out in D.C. Libby, hope to see you there.
Yeah, I'm going
to
take you to some lanyard bars. We're going to hit on some lobbyists.
Hopefully we'll get into a fist fight with Michael Rappaport.
I am gonna bottom out in the desk.
Okay. Until next time, guys.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody. Cheers. Thanks, Libby. Steel shoes on the stone cold floor. I hear the screws screaming in the corridor. The bad news and the slamming of the door. The what did I do's and the what I'm gonna hear.
I'm talking about character. I'm talking about. Elio, I ain't embarrassed to use the word. I'm talking about ethics.